Hey everyone, I'm Justin Gray with Toolpath, and this is Chips and Tips. And today I'm joined by Garrett Wade. Say hi, Garrett.
Hey, how you doing?
Garrett and I are going to be talking about templates and template files today. But before we jump into that, Garrett, why don't you give everybody a short introduction? Say hi.
My name is Garrett Wade. I run with a buddy of mine a small shop here in Orlando, Florida. We mostly work on aftermarket automotive parts and really focus on trying to make some of the nicest parts that we possibly can.
Your parts are gorgeous, unbelievably gorgeous. I wish I could make parts that nice.
Thank you.
Okay. If you want to know more about Garrett's backstory, he went into deep detail on it on episode 202 of Within Tolerance. So go check that out. But today we're going to focus on templates. I asked Garrett to join me because I think honestly he's gone probably deeper than most of my other colleagues on template stuff, and I thought we could dig into some really interesting topics. So let's start with the most basic one. What is a template?
For me, I think a template is just any file or any sort of setup or anything that takes information and stores it for you so you could use it later. That could be something to reference. It could be something to use. I think we'll get into that a little bit deeper, but in general, I think it's just designed to capture data so you can use it later or reference it later.
Right. I think so. Like, even if all you did was open up the last part you programmed and use that as a starting point to program your next part, that's a template.
Yeah. I mean, in a situation like that, like a lot of people will do that for, you know, like a left and right. You'd have a reference file. Like, here's what I did. And you're not trying to reinvent the wheel. You just streamline the process. Here's what I did on this one. Let me reapply that over here or use the same parameters over here, et cetera.
Or even just like, I know I had all my tools built up in that file, so I'll go grab it.
Yep.
Tools are an interesting topic because I actually do know some folks who use templates to store their tool libraries, and whether that's a good practice or not is a whole nother question. But I think that is one of the key benefits of templates, especially if you don't have like a super dialed tool library with all your presets really, really refined, but you know that you programmed a part previously and that there are tools in there with good feeds and speeds,
sure.
Then it can save you a lot of time to just start with that, even if you don't use any of the setups or anything. There are other templates in Fusion, though, and so sometimes the verb or the noun template gets confusing, right? You can have templated toolpaths from Fusion, and that's not what we're talking about.
Sure. I mean, template toolpaths can be great, but there's a number of other ways you can use templates. Using Fusion's example, you can use their file system to sort of create templates on your own. Fusion's got a little template library, and you can have just toolpaths as a template and apply those. But I think the underutilized thing is using files as a whole as templates.
Right. So just for the audience context, but like the two things we're talking about here are is you could right click on a toolpath and say, save it as a template. And then that stores off to the side and you can go to another context menu and like create a toolpath from template. That's a quick way to save one or more toolpaths, like a recipe, and then add it to any file, or a template file, or sometimes I think Phil Nestenhauser calls it a workflow template. That's a slightly different concept where you have like a pre-built set of assets, toolpaths or setups already sitting there in the file, and then you make a copy of that file to work from.
Yeah, no, I think Philip's gone deeper in this than almost anyone has. with some of his, but
So sometimes there's another term that comes out there, and I called the container method, and I feel like that gets mixed in with templates. The container method can sometimes be a little imposing, but they're not the same thing, right? So they can be used together, and you can get extra mileage out of your templates by leveraging the container method if you want to. But you absolutely don't have to use a container method to use a Fusion template. So the distinction there, I think, and correct me if you see it differently, is like a template file is a really general thing. Like the most basic template I can imagine would be nothing in it except two empty setups or even just one empty setup. And that setup has your WCS already configured, your relative stock settings the way you want, and maybe a few tool paths in it that are like set up with the tools you want, and nothing else in there. Versus the container method, which is like adding in the design workspace, it's like adding literal containers and using them to hold certain pieces of geometry or associate tool paths with them to add like additional automation on top of the basic container, or sorry, the basic template. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think it's worth giving a little context. In Fusion, Fusion makes a distinction between bodies and components. Components as a whole are effectively a container or a folder that have a work coordinate system and an origin. So they may have other components in them. They may have bodies in them. But in the context of this, people are using those components as a container and leveraging that to be able to hold some sort of data, and they're not pre-filling it, or they are pre-filling it. So in the container method, a lot of times you may have a container that has work holding. You may have a container that's listed as stock and one that's listed as the model. And when you save it as a template, you'd leave the, in this case, the model empty, but point your setups to that. So anything that you dump into that container or into that component, the setups will automatically regenerate because they're already pointing towards this. There was nothing in there, and now it's populated.
Somebody, I think one of my developers, Sandy, told me recently, he put it this way, and I actually hadn't thought about it, but you mentioned that containers have their own work coordinates or their own origin. When you put a bunch of bodies and other children inside a component, they behave as if they're in a rigid group together. So if you then move that component, you're moving all the children of that component.
Yeah, in Fusion world, that's why I make that distinction. If a component has its own origin and its own work coordinate system, and anytime you want to move things or create an assembly, unless you're just going to draw a handful of bodies and they're going to be in place, but if you want to actually assemble things, they need to be in different components. And what you do when you're making joints or assemblies in Fusion is you're defining how those coordinate systems interact or how they are relative to each other in space. So the only thing that a component has to be is just an empty thing with a coordinate system. It could have sketches or bodies or this or that. So yeah, if you had a handful of sketches or a handful of bodies and they're all in one component and you move that component, they'll all drag with it because they're all in their own little solar system of sorts, and you can drag them around.
But the critical point there is that when you make joints in Fusion, that those are made from containers to containers. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, your inputs in a joint may be relative to a body that's within that component, but I think behind the scenes, what's actually happening is it's aligning those two coordinate systems to each other in some way. And so when you make your selections, you're just defining how those should be aligned.
And that intersects with template files, because a lot of folks will set up parametric stock and then joint it to their work holding. And there's a couple of really slick ways to do that. I like Phil's way pretty nicely. I know you've got a way to do that too. But when you set up joints like that, you end up using components, one for the stock and one for your work holding, so that you can set up those joints.
Yeah.
And I guess.
I was just going to clarify and say I'm using mostly what Phil's doing. My hierarchy, for a few reasons, is I think slightly different than what Phil's doing. But that system works great.
Going really deep into the sort of joint theory that Phil has developed, I think is a topic for another day.
100%.
But the critical information there for me when I was. So I undertook an effort to, and we're building this into toolpath as well. But like, I know lots of folks struggle with template files, and the container method is just honestly just not widely adopted. And I was like, why is that? And I think as you get good at those things, you tend to build pretty complex files that can have lots of containers and pretty specific joint structures. And that can be both overwhelming for somebody who didn't build the file or doesn't have access to the person who built the file. And two, sometimes just like really difficult. I'm pretty good at joints in Fusion. And even then, I sometimes just get really frustrated when things don't line up the way I want and you have to like go inspect the joint structure. But nevertheless, I think there's a lot of value in having like a pretty simple template file with some really basic components in it and a really simple joint structure to get your parametric stock lined up. And effectively, when you set that file up and then use that as the foundation for how you program, that is a template with a container method in it. It's just a really, really simple one, a version of that.
Sure.
I think that for me was key because as we push things out for Toolpath, we'll probably look at doing container method and template files in more of a constructive way. So rather than having a file that you customized and built, you'll still be able to do that if you want to build your own container methods. But we'll probably push out like a really simple, like best practice template file. And hopefully give people as much customization as we can within some amount of constraints. But to get to that path, I went down this route of like, how simple can I make this? What can I delete? Do I need that join? Do I need this join? What containers do I think are really critically necessary? And so that's how I arrived on like, okay, I need some containers because I tried to build a template that I thought was foundationally useful without it. And I found that I needed at least a container to hold my work holding. Because you can't do joints without that.
Sure. Yeah. You can't do any sort of assembly without them being in a component. And so by nature, we're calling components and containers
the same thing
yeah. Here. Yeah.
We're kind of abusing Fusion's terminology there.
Well, in this case, it's funny. We're actually using it not necessarily what it was intended for. Right. You know, they build a structure and then guys like Phil realize they could leverage it in a slightly different way. And then we're just compounding on that and abusing it pretty heavily.
Okay, so we've covered like what the definition of a template file is, a little bit of how it's different from like what Fusion has as template toolpaths. We talked about the difference between container method and template files and how they can work together, but you don't have to use one to use the other. So I guess we're making a pitch that folks should use template files. What kind of things do you leverage a template file to like improve your workflow on?
Going down the rabbit hole of templates for me started with just the annoyance of doing the same tasks over and over again. Initially, it was just work holding, and that was really one of the only things we were using. As we moved from 3-axis into 5-axis stuff, collisions became much more of a problem. So the necessity to have work holding in our file was basically created, and it was almost not an option anymore. Where before, we would almost never do it. In 3-axis, a lot of times, if you stay above the jaw, you're fine, and there's no real collisions that are going to happen. As soon as you start turning on the side, then you're sort of forced into it. There's reasons why you probably should put work holding in 3-axis, but that's really what drove us a couple years ago. So I started adding those just to save time. I found it really annoying when I wanted to do even a rather simple part to try to build out the vise and build out this. So going back to what a template file basically is, just having work holding pre-built and using that as opposed to every single time, sort of, let me create joints between my stock and my vise. That's really what drove the beginning of using them for us and what those first gains really were. After that, we started to move more into, you know, using, like we talked about before, just Fusion templates, or in some cases, putting, creating full template files or container method kind of files to save time.
There's a nice tie into one of the struggles I have with Toolpath as a technology and like developing it. So the tool library is a major challenge for Toolpath. And I know you're one of the more advanced users working through like our preset naming and everything. We're working really hard to kind of reimagine how you interact with the tool to a library a little bit to make some of that fade into the background a little bit more. But it's a real challenge because even folks like you who have some of the most well-organized tool libraries I've seen still don't have like a perfectly consistent preset naming scheme. And so that's hard for Toolpath, which really wants like a really consistent preset naming scheme. I find it interesting. That's a big friction point for people onboarding to Toolpath. And the analogy I try to draw is exactly the one you just referenced, which is like when folks started moving from three-axis to multi-axis, like modeling your tool holders and your work holding became, I don't want to say non-optional. There are people who are crazy and do it without it, but like much, much, much more valuable, right?
I think that grows with the complexity of the part in general, because even if you go back and do larger three-axis parts, right? If you did, not to knock on anybody's parts of any kind, but if you had a 1-inch by 1-inch little cube you were going to make, and that's all it was, it's not really important. But even if you got into, a 6-8, 10-inch tall three-axis part, there may be times when the head of the machine or the tool holder or whatever goes below the top level of the part. And so having some sort of confidence or the ability to check in collisions in that becomes, I think, a necessity. And so without having all of that data in your file, it's just a guess, right? Or you're at the machine just sweating.
Yeah. But on three axis, it's like nice to have. But on five axis, like every part basically will always run into that problem. And so it's an order of magnitude more valuable there for multi-axis. Sure. And so now that's when people really started modeling tool holders and when CAM systems started figuring out how to make it easier to model tool holders. And so now as we try to push forward into this world of automation, that same burden of like increased information now falls on your tool library itself. That's a bit of an aside. But I think it's pretty valuable to zoom in on like what you had said before of like you started with template files even in three axis, and there are some benefits there. If we zoom in on work holding, I'm only doing three and sometimes four axis right now, hopefully 3+2 soon. But I get a lot of value out of 0-point work holding and template files to let me leverage 0-point work holding. So let's dig into that a little bit more, because I think that topic sometimes gets missed. Like 0 points are great for saving you actual like physical time and setting up your machine. But I think maybe a little bit underappreciated is how much time they can save you in CAM too.
Sure. I mean, there's a number of ways that can save time. We started using 0 points when we moved into 5-axis, but going back and doing more 3-axis work, we started to take aspects of that and using it there. In the context of a template file, if you had a 0 point, you could have all of the work holding set up in there and set up those setups. And you could even set up where the WCS is, and that's in a known location. And that brings with it some benefits like probing and this and that. And that can already be pre-set up. But even if you don't have a true 0 point, even if you're using a regular vise, like a CURT or something along those lines, you could pick any known place on that.
And back left corner of the fixed jaw, yeah.
Yep, just a common thing, and use that in a similar workflow as a 0 point. Obviously, you're not going to pick up that vise and put it back down in the same way, but anytime you did move the vise on the table, if you picked up that spot, then you'd have a known location, and that could be used to drive things. You don't necessarily need to pick up that spot again. You don't need to select a unique spot every time or set a unique spot every time.
I know Chris Zappatini builds a lot of his turnkeys that way for customers. He's like, look, we're going to build everything off a 0 point that's on the back corner of this vise. So if you take the vise off the table and put it back on, just make sure you probe that corner and everything else will work, right? And he can drive in-process probing relative to that corner and everything can still work. And I think that's another topic that's underappreciated, which is that taking the time to model some part of your work holding, some part of something that can be used as a fixed reference, whether it's back corner of your vise or a 0 point location on a plate or something, that gives you the ability to then do in-process probing driven off that 0 point, rather than having to manually go and probe to initialize the work coordinate system and then probe off that work coordinate system.
Yeah, that brings up an interesting sort of tangential topic of sort of process templates, where it's not necessarily a file, right? But it makes sense a lot of times to develop a process and use that as a template and use it over and over again. That way you're not reinventing the wheel. And when you do something like we were talking about there with a vise and you select that back left corner, not only does it get easier to drive it in Fusion, but if you were to pick up that vise and put it back down somewhere on the table, you pick up that corner. But that doesn't just allow that singular file to work. If you always use that workflow, that allows the file from 2 years ago to work without you having to refigure out, how did I set this up last time? Where was this? Once you do that, all the information needed to make that file can exist within that one file. And so you can just open the file and hit go. There's not a lot of information that needs to be pre-set up in the machine. Like, let me figure out where the work coordinate system was. Let me set it. Let me go through. As long as you always set your, in air quotes here, 0 point, you should be able to just open your file and hit go and you're good, because that's going to drive everything.
Yeah. So I'm almost a little embarrassed to admit it, but sort of revelatory to me. I mean, I'd heard Chris talk about his probing setups and stuff. But to realize that like you could use almost any kind of fixed reference as a 0 point, that like we talk about 0 point plates like Lang or HWR, Fifth Axis makes great ones. And I guess that's like the original sort of like repeatable take it on and off 0 point. But if you have something like a fixed jaw vise that is like self-referenceable, then you can use that as a fixed point too.
Yeah, you just need to have, I think, some point in space that's sacred. And if that point ever moves, we just make sure the first thing we do is grab that point. And then we're always referencing that point, and we'll call that basically our 0 point. It's always the zero location.
And I guess even like Pearson Pallets, he's, now that I think about it, he's pitched that same idea for years, which is like probe off this pin on my vacuum system, on my vacuum pallet system. And then no matter where you put that on the table, just pick that up and you drive off that and your programs are good to go.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, even with the Pearson, whether we're talking about that or a vise, it doesn't matter. And I think the value with that stuff, or that workflow, is not only that it can make it easier the first time, but it makes it easier every time, right. You go to do it. If you were to pick up your Pearson pallet system and move it, you know, as soon as you put it back down, you need to make sure you probe it in, which I think is easy enough to do. Most of us, if we were going to pick up a vise and put it on there, we're going to tram it into the table or something, make sure it's good. And so if you just make it your process to also pick up that location when you're doing that, then you don't ever have to worry about anything else. Everything you drive on that vise is good to go.
Yeah. So I think that's an important, at least for me, an important insight that I hadn't fully drawn together before just talking to you now, which is that we have template files, we have standardized processes, and we have 0 points, and they all kind of synergize together to make a much more robust setup for running your shop, running your machine.
Yeah, all of those together, if you pick out or design a workflow or a template system and they work together nicely, it can simplify the amount of work that you have to do. It can reduce the things you have to figure out in each part that you make. And it can also make it safer, because you're going to reduce the number of variables that are things that could be subject to human error, right? Every time, rather than me selecting, rather than me figuring out, rather than, as we talked about before, the possibility for you to set one of these things wrong, if it's always the same, there's no question about that. Then it's not a thing that you're checking. A lot of people like to have standard file or standard tools in their machine, right? And one of the benefits of having a standard tool is not only so you don't have to grab it, that's sort of a template, it's already there, but also it's usually a tool that you don't worry about. Like, I just know that one's good, so I only have to touch off the ones that are unique to this. And it's helpful to think of a template file or a templated workflow of some kind in the same way. You just offload all that worry of all those variables.
Yeah. So a really powerful template in that context would be a Fusion file that has a couple of setups built into it that are pre-designed to probe your part off your zero-point origin, using that to drive the location of the probe. And then even if you use that probed value to set like G54 or something, that's fine. You could, there are other workflows where you can like kind of create a virtual zero-point and update its location using like offset probing techniques. This the way that I like to do it, but it's a little more sort of conceptually weird to think about. So even if you're just using your zero point to drive your initial probe to set G54, that's still a very robust workflow that you can rely on. And if you really wanted to have, I don't know, like, let's say you don't run your machine very often or something, you could have like in that template, one of your core tools come down and like draw a square 3 inches above your zero point or something, just air cut, just so you visually see like, okay, this is in the place I expected it to be. I'm not going to crash into anything. I'm good to go. I've seen some folks do things like that, or even just build something where like your workflow template has like a very simple toolpath that comes and draws a line over, like draws an X over where it thinks the zero point should be in the air, just to sort of visually verify, yes, my G59 is programmed correctly, or my cam is picking up G59, my zero point, and then from there I'm good to go.
Yeah. Ours doesn't move, obviously, because it's a proper zero point we're using, but in one-off files, I'll regularly leave the probing to be extremely high. So the probe comes in, and when it goes to probe Z, which if it's in the center of the part and center of the zero point, it's not going to hit anything. There's no way you can have a collision. So once that thing turns on and moves down, if it's moving down in a protective move, it'll find where it's at. And if that's got the tolerance settings turned on or the location-based settings turned on, it'll sort of sanity check everything looks right. This is in a proper location. This is good. And so the idea of leaving that to be admittedly a longer probing setup, but one that comes down and touches the top of Z, which really shouldn't be necessary for a zero point, can give you that sanity check.
Yeah. Even if your physical zero point never moves, I have a terrible memory, and I always forget to change the WCS in my file if I'm building it manually. And so that's like, yeah, it's just, I guess I actually like your version of it better, of having Z do a protected move to the top of stock. That's a much nicer solution. It's just comforting to me to like, yes, even though I'm using a template file, even though this should be good, let's make sure we don't smash anything into anything else here.
Yeah, we just going into the, which is related to this, the safety of workflow method. I mean, we generally probe everything with the exception of like obtuse stuff that's in a soft jaw. And I just cut the soft jaw on the theoretical, and then immediately I'm cutting the part in that same theoretical. Yeah. But any sort of first op stuff or anything like that, unnecessarily, I'll probe every single access always. And then run it off another access, because then we know for sure it's great. And we can do those size checks or location checks if we feel that may be necessary. And then that's another thing that we can template in there, right? The probing stuff can be templated in there. And it's just one less thing to worry about either at the machine or in Fusion. It's a template. You just have that in the file. You hit go, and I know it's safe.
Speaking of soft jaws and templates, do you have a template for cutting soft jaws?
I do. That one, because it gets utilized in other files, is a Fusion template. So just the toolpaths are templated.
Oh, interesting.
Because I don't know what files I'm going to add that to. And so we'll use the container method on occasion for some stuff. And I think most people should. But we have a weird workflow where in some cases we'll build out the file in the original file. And in some cases we'll have a specific cam, like extra cam file, or multiple files will make sense to be in one. So relying for me on a method that forces you to put it into something else always doesn't make sense. So we have those, some of those container methods built out. But in the case of Softjaws, I wanted that to be robust and be able to be added immediately to anything. So that one's a Fusion file, a Fusion template.
Okay. I like that. For us, and what I think I'm going to be pushing for Toolpath is a pre-built template that has like a Softjaw workflow in it as one of the setups that you can just use or not use. I like that workflow because I can build a bunch of geometry, parametric geometry in. I really, really like the HWR Softjaws I use, the soft click ones. There is no hardware like from the top. I think the orange vice ones are very similar. There's no bolts from the top, right?
There's no bolts from the top in the orange. There's a small set screw on the side. I think from what you and I have talked and what I've seen, the HWR stuff seems really nice because it has less interferences underneath.
Right. And the I think the Lang Profolio ones work similar, but I like that because I don't have to like think about avoiding any hardware or anything, and I can cut, you know, I reuse soft jaws for different stuff, so I can like face them down. So I've set that up as a pretty clean parametric template, parametric geometry in my template with all my work holding and everything. And I like that to just be in the file. I even can put some ancillary geometry into the soft jaw. I often do exactly what you did, which is cut the soft jaw off my zero point and then put the part in there. But then those soft jaws come off the machine. And then if I want to use them again, I don't have that reference anymore. So I'll throw a bore or something in so that I can, you know, if tolerance really, really matters, I can pick up that bore on the soft jaw again. So I like to have all of that sort of pre-built in my template ready to go. That saves me a lot of time, which I think brings me to like the theory of templates a little bit. What I've learned recently, and I'm curious if you agree with this, but what I learned a lot from Phil is that the best way, and some of this has to do with how Fusion deals with parameters from imported components and links, but if you want to build any parametric geometry and you're building a template, I think the best practice is all your parametric geometry should just go in the top level template file, and any Xreft components shouldn't be parametric at all. You should, if you need them to move around, you should figure out how to use joints to deal with that. So I think all the parameters for anything you need live in your top level template file, not in any of the child files. I don't know of any way to make child parameters work really smoothly. Do you?
Not while keeping them linked.
As soon as you break the link.
Yeah, and that's sort of, I mean, that's what we're doing with the work holding stuff. If you break the top level stuff, you can sort of bring all your parameters in there. If you were to break the lower level child stuff, you could bring the parameters in there, but then you lose that tie back. And so if you wanted to make updates, if you wanted to, it depends if that matters for you. If it doesn't, our earliest template files of sorts, the workholding files, every single one was broke always. It was always a single vice with stock in it. The stock had a couple parameters for size. You'd insert it and break that link. And there was no way to modify that. If you wanted to change, let's say, what the vice was later, right? It's completely gone and lost. So we've moved away from that workflow, utilizing some of what Phil did there to be able to change that. But yeah, the only way I know of to make any changes to it is to physically break that link, and that'll bring with it all its baggage and thus the ability to change stuff.
Okay. All right. I think that's actually a pretty important point. If you're willing to break the link, which is a few extra clicks and an extra step you have to remember to do, then you can have some parametric building blocks that you can use to kind of compose a template. The challenge there is you're only composing the geometry. You're not like bringing toolpaths and stuff with it. I think Fusion does have some functionality for that now, but I haven't been super successful in using it. They call it like cam of cams or something.
I think that's worked pretty well for us when we've used it in a couple scenarios, but I don't think it's what most people would think it is or want it is. I think for the most part, that's designed for you to have something like a vice and a single part programmed, and maybe not have the riser or the zero point in there. And then the idea is you would insert that in onto a pyramid or a tombstone or something like that and have multiple instances of it. And if you're not using it in that sort of workflow, your mileage may vary right now.
Okay, so we've covered the basics of templates versus container methods. I think you and I are reasonably in agreement that like one of the foundational advantages of template files is that you should include your work holding in there and leverage some kind of a zero-point system. That's where some of the real big efficiency gains come in. And then you put out this idea of like a process template that's very reliable. There are some downsides to that, though. We've suffered a few of them here. We picked a weird zero point. Originally, I didn't have a gauging palette, and so I just picked like the right corner of one of my risers. And now I have a gauging palette, and I'd like to change my zero point. But now a lot of my old processes are broken. And so you can build up some real big inertia around a process template that can make things very sticky and hard to change.
Sure. No, building out a process, especially if you haven't worked in that environment for a long time, can definitely cause some problems because you may pick out a process that doesn't work, or if you decide to make major changes to the process, there can be some abrasion there.
Yeah. So for us, like, as we move our zero point, what we decided to do was use two different zero points. Like, the old zero point stays G59, and the new zero point becomes, I don't know, some extended works offset, G54.1, P100 or something. And so we let both processes live side by side. And then at some point, we'll sunset the old process completely. But that's an interesting sort of challenge that I think people should consider as they start building out these processes. Is I don't think you have to be afraid of it, but just be aware that those processes can build up some inertia that you may or may not, you know, be able to overcome later.
Yep. I'm assuming you'll be able to find a fairly easy transition between those if you want to dig in and do something silly. If the corner of your riser was, let's say, G59, right, and the new one's G58, if you could measure the distance between those, you could always put a macro or something in the post, right, that adds it to it. And if the old one was used, it automatically converts it to the new one. Or if the new one was used, it converts it to the old one and swaps back and forth.
Ooh, that's extra fancy. I like that a lot. That's really cool.
That does have its downsides of now you've forever got that legacy code floating around or need to have it in there or whatever. But yeah, I'm assuming you could make that safe by auto-converting it.
Right. I think once you have like a process defined in your template file and you can rely on a zero point, if you're comfortable with macros or if you have like application support from an outside person that can help you, there's a lot of unlocks that can come from that. Like all of a sudden you now have a reliable point that you can build processes around. For me, and actually what kicked off the idea for this whole conversation was that even though we use a lot of templates, we also do a lot of weird things at Toolpath, a lot of development where we're sort of pretending to be the same as our customers who don't always use templates. Or we're generating like on the fly composing templates for like output from our add-in, our Fusion add-in. And so there's just all kinds of weird stuff going on in our shop where there's a lot of non-standard things. And I've had Z crashes, not proud of it, but I've had Z crashes. And often the cause of that crash is I forgot to set the right work offset in CAM. I meant to probe G54. But I forgot, or G56, but I left it as G54 in Fusion. So leveraging a zero point and some other neat tricks that I learned about the Fusion post, I was able to write a macro that verified that my WCS offset was the same as what it would have been, as what CAM expected it to be. Now, to make that work, I had to have a good template file and a machine model that's calibrated to match my physical machine. But it's a nice thing that I can only do when I'm using zero point work holding. And in my case, a calibrated machine model. And it's kind of a funny result for me because, I mean, essentially, like once you have that all in there, you pointed out, like, why don't you just use the zero point to set up probing and then you never have the wrong work coordinate system? Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, we got into an interesting discussion there because it was really based on process and what makes the most sense. And so I think in that scenario, you ran into an issue and leveraged some macros and setting up some things in Fusion to build a process that would make it error-proof. It would check the error. And then I brought up the idea or half argued with you, why not go sort of one step above and set it here every time to not allow the error to ever exist,
Right.
which negates the need to check for the error.
Yeah. And so, more concretely, just for everybody else's context, the specific issue that I'm dealing with is that we do sometimes slash often hand wheel jog to probe in a part. Even though, ironically, I have modeled the work holding and everything is set up in the Fusion file. And so, Garrett's point was like, look, in theory, you have the 0 point, you know where your part is, you could just post in process probing to get that working. And you're 100% right. We could augment our process so that the in process probing from Fusion would be based off the 0 point and everything should just work. In our case, though, we're not always posting. In fact, Fusion does, or Toolpath doesn't post in process probing. And so if we're replicating an exact customer workflow, oftentimes we're hand wheeling to probe in. And so that's why we need that check, because I forget to set the WCS. We're hand probing a part. Even though I still find a lot of value in modeling my work holding for simulation and those kinds of things. So the macro I built leveraged the fact that I have, a machine model and my work holding model to add an error check. Whereas you would have expanded the process to make it more automated and less error prone.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like you said, you have different constraints and you're trying to replicate different people's workflows, what they're going to be, and not everyone's going to have all that in there. And so not everyone could use that. If somebody didn't have, and they definitely should, they didn't have their work holding in there, they didn't have everything modeled in the correct location, then obviously trying to drive a probe is a bit harder. And if they don't even have a probe in the machine, obviously that makes it exponentially harder to use a
Right.
probe. So some sort of workflow or error check has a lot of value. I was going back and forth with you, obviously thinking about how I do stuff and knowing that you have this available, but not thinking about it through the lens of like, we do this other weird stuff sometimes and we need to
Oh.
replicate what customers do.
You know, I never thought of that, but you raise a really valid point. The macro that I wrote is really valuable for folks who are probing with like a Hymer or an indicator, but still would like the benefit of validating that they've posted the right offset, or if they're relying on simulation, maybe you're getting real close to your vice jaws or something, or you have fourth axis work or whatever. I struggle to imagine probing in a Hymer on a five axis machine, but, you know, three and even four axis, people do that pretty regularly. So that's a really good example where a template file with work holding modeled and a machine model could benefit from some macro magic.
Sure. And
Yeah.
we talked about previously in a three-axis configuration using just bits and pieces of yours to still have some safety
Right.
checks.
Like just making sure Z is where you expect it to be. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the vast majority of crashes are in Z because somebody sets that wrong. A lot of times if it's just XY, it's not a big deal. Maybe you slot through the part or something like that. If the Z is dramatically off, that's going to be that rapid down that hits and that really nasty thing first. If it did rapid down in Z and then moved in X and Y and that was your crash, I think you should have just been paying attention a little bit.
You don't have any apprentice marks on your vices, right? None. You've never
These vices, no. I don't know if I. Three axis stuff, we've done some things before for sure. We that was a big moment for me that I thought was funny. I came from using a really small Akabi-based machine where 5 or 10 thou would stall the spindle completely, or snap the tool. One or the other was going to happen, and so you couldn't have anything wrong. And then when we started using an old Fidal, so a proper VMC but an older one. And one of the early parts we did on that, the work coordinate system was just wrong. It was just off by like 2 or 3 inches. and it came down and just immediately slotted through the part at like 150, 200 inches a minute with a half inch end mill. And the idea that like everything was fine and everything was kosher, but it just slotted through the part. I was like, this is completely different. but
I had just bought a pair of brand new orange vices to, and then my whole team came out. And this is an example where modeling your work holding would have saved me, even for a three axis part, but we weren't modeling the work holding. And, there was a cut that had to come down between the jaws. And I can't remember the geometry of the part anymore, but for some reason we were coming down in between the jaws, on op one. And we ran the program the first time and it was fine, but we wanted to make some small change. I can't remember what it is now. It might have, honestly, it might have only been stock to leave. Like we might have been walking in a feature or something. But when we made that change, Fusion modified where it was putting the lead in and lead out. And so it went from being perfectly fine to slotting, to putting a, not slotting, but like it kissed the jaws. And I was like, these are brand new, like that we've used them for literally an hour. And then we just marked up the jaws. And so had I modeled that work holding and simulated it, it would have caught it, but we were running, you know, the part in free space and being like, it's three axis. It'll be okay. And it bit me. That was one of the lessons that really forced me to start thinking about like, okay, I'm always, I just always model my work holding. Always is like, sometimes I do weird stuff, but like when I do that weird stuff, I start paying like really close attention to what I'm doing. And like the only time I really feel comfortable running the machine is when I have the work holding modeled.
I mean, luckily now those types of mistakes are getting more and more difficult, to do, I think, because the access to information on how to build proper work holding models or the models themselves, are available through a bunch of people. Toolpath, you know, you guys are integrating models into it, for the work holding. Autodesk has a pretty decent library. Most of the manufacturers now have readily available on their site. So adding that, the barrier to entry has become, a lot lower. And then Autodesk also released, the fixture avoidance stuff by default. So if you have that in there, depending on which toolpath it is, it's either just not going to do it because it's got some default values that just won't allow it if it's in there, or at bare minimum, you're going to see it in simulation, right? Which you'll see it check. And so it slowly becomes more and more difficult. But if you just avoid all of the opportunities you have to check that, yeah, I mean, you could still trash some stuff real quick.
That fixture avoidance stuff, I really like it. But when it first came out, it bit me really hard a couple of times. Only because for some reason I had like really large fixture avoidance tolerances, like 5 millimeters or something. Mm-hmm. And so the 3D adaptive toolpaths were just like refusing to mill the part. And I could not, I think one time I might've spent like 45 minutes trying to figure out what setting was wrong in 3D adaptive. And it's that the setting that I needed to change was over in the setup folder where there's like a clearance defined for fixture avoidance. So I know to go look there now, although occasionally it still bites me, when we're doing testing or something and the toolpath just looks weird and I don't think to go check fixture avoidance. So there's a pro tip. If you're getting weird results from 3D adaptive, it might be that your fixture avoidance is preventing it from getting closer. Okay. I think that takes us to machine models. We mentioned them a little bit. Not everybody uses them. Fusion has a pretty good library of ready-to-go machine models. They're not that hard to build yourself. Although also like some of your support guys like DSI can help you build ones out real easily too. Should we be using machine models and do they play a role in templates? Do they have a place in templates?
Yeah. I mean, depending on how deep the rabbit hole you want to go, I think they play a huge role in them. For anybody that doesn't know, I guess the machine models allow you to have 3D geometry of your machine in Fusion. You can apply kinematics and a post-processor to that. So then you can run simulation to see what your clearances or potential collisions would be while running your part. That has the added benefit of letting you do some interesting things in post. You can sort of template different options in the post where you have maybe one post processor and you sort of template in, I want to use these options if I'm using this machine and these options with this machine. And even though you've got a unified post, you sort of pick what you want and error proof or sort of template what post options or how this thing should be used. But machine model.
Give me an example there.
There was a discussion I had with other people the other day about high feed, for example, which is some machines like the Haas does not do well in a multi-axis reposition if you were to full rapid, where something like a Hi9 or something like that does just fine in that. And so you could template out and say, I mean, in that case, you're not going to use the same post, but you could template out and say, anytime I select this machine, I want this option used in all these toolpaths. And when I want this machine, I want this one. And that one, you wouldn't be using the same post, but you may run the same file on two different machines. You may run it on a Hermite today and a Haas tomorrow, and you want things in the toolpath to just change because the machine handles that differently. And so
How do
you
you
can.
achieve that? How do you achieve that template, actually? I don't know. How do you make it remember the post parameters when you change machines?
When you have a post property, you can change it instead of like an operation property and put in that property at a toolpath level. You can put it as a machine property and then set the default there. But either way, on the machine level, you can define what that machine's supposed to be, was supposed to have. It could be something as simple as we have a UMC 500 and a UMC 1000 SS, and those are effectively the same machine. But they do have different travels. And so besides getting visual stuff, I can get over travel warnings just built into simulation. The Haas post processor does have some drop downs where you could select the kinematic without using a machine, but you're not going to get over travel warnings. And so it may not be till you run the code on the machine that you know, hey, this toolpath's going to over travel or have a problem. So using the machine sort of templates all that and gives you some info ahead of time. Additionally, using machines allows you to use machine simulation in Fusion, and machine simulation will give you a more accurate simulation because it runs it through the post processor as opposed to just showing you the theoretical.
As a bit of a public service announcement there, I found out recently, because we have some really good post guys here at Toolpath they came from Autodesk. As Autodesk has upgraded machine simulation capability, they've modified the post. And so if you're using a very, very old post, it's possible you're not getting the most out of your machine simulation. I think the most recent change was that the post can now, depending on your post, you can now simulate transition moves, from Toolpath. It didn't used to do that. And so, if you're going to try to catch like a crash or a weird motion during, motion between two different toolpaths, linking moves essentially, make sure you have an updated post. And if you don't, go get somebody to help you get an updated post. If you're using a Haas, Fusion keeps those posts updated like all the time.
Sure. Yeah, in the example of even, yeah, I mean, even a three-axis machine, right? If you had a Haas VF, you could have a very large part, and maybe it machines on one side of it. And when it goes to do the tool change, if you're not using machine sim, you would just see the tool go straight up and then sort of disappear, and the new one comes down. Where if you were using machine sim and you had all the linking, you would see it transverse over, and you may see a collision of the part and the tool just on that linking during a tool change or something. So it's a lot safer. It gives you a lot more data. That data is more accurate. There's a lot of times where the post can modify what the theoretical is, like in the regular simulation. So using machine sim is wildly beneficial.
I've never gotten an over travel warning since I started using a machine sim, but I've only been making really small parts since then. When I was doing job shop work and learning, I made a couple of parts right at the limit of my travels. And it cost me, man, I think like a couple of hours of time trying to work around. Like I have a too big face mail, a 3-inch face mail is way, way too big for my BT30 machine, but, three inch face mill. Yeah, 3 inch face mill. And so like right when you're at the limits of travel on your machine, like a big face mill just push you over the edge. And man, I was like, oh yeah, I can make this part. And I was just too inexperienced to realize how much of a headache using that face mill was going to be. And trying to like reposition the part and reprobe it in and just get it exactly right to avoid the over travel. I wasted hours and hours of time doing that. God, that was a bad day.
I mean, we had the same, before, I don't remember if this was before they added some of the over travel warnings, or maybe I just didn't have them properly set up initially, but some of the early 5Xs stuff we did, it was effectively porting and going down in, spiraling down into the bottom, but the machine had to tilt on its side and then go down in Z really far to get as far as we needed to go. And it kept just getting over travel alarms in Z. We were going Z too low. And we already were using an absurdly long tool, or at least I thought it didn't sound great to begin with there. And so, you know, the move wasn't to just pull it out an absurd amount. So we just kept having to inch it out just a little bit more and rerun it and hope it was good. And then do that again, because I, you know, we just didn't know. Now, if we set up the gauge length at Fusion properly, run machine sim, it'll tell me right away. And so we can make sort of large changes, run it in simulation, see how far it is out of the travels, and then adjust the gauge length accordingly and see if that works or see if we need to swap tools.
Was that part big enough that you couldn't have just thrown a riser underneath it?
So risers don't... If you're talking about over 90 degree work, risers make things worse.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Cause you move further off center line. So ideally the closer to the table it is, the better, right? Otherwise your Z just becomes even more.
Got it. Right. Okay. So machine models are pretty valuable. And another reason to leverage templates is to have your machine models pre-set up. So if you're moving stuff from machine to machine, which it sounds like you do successfully, you go from the 500 to the 1000 pretty successfully.
Yeah, we do some parts that obviously have to go on one. The larger parts have to go on the bigger machine, but regularly we'll set up parts between for one of the machines and need to move it to the other. If the clearances aren't terrible, then we'll be able to swap it over. And we've leveraged some of Phil's templates to do that successfully. One of the pain points we had previously was the vices would change, the zero point would change, or there'd be times where, like I said, maybe it clears on the 500, the smaller machine, just fine for all the multi-axis moves. But once we got into the bigger machine, there may be a collision with the table, so we may need to add a riser or something like that. And the pain of just adding work holding manually to the file and then wanting to swap to the other machine, I would end up with these files that had a bunch of work holding and duplicates of op one, because I wouldn't want to lose my op one. And then, you know, here's a duplicate with a riser. Here's it. So, yeah, we successfully swap back and forth now. And what makes that clean and so painless is template files. We're using a configuration sort of like he built out. And we just swap the vice, and then I swap the machine in the file, hit regen, and are able to run it on the other machine.
Do you have the same RPM spindle on both machines?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, so you have a little bit of an advantage there. There are some things you can do. You can the smoothest workflow in Fusion is to use some post-processor hacks that could adjust the feed-in speeds for you and kind of hold chip load constant, but... there's not a great solution for that yet. I hope someday Toolpath will be the answer to that. Like, just regenerate it on a new machine.
But, sure. Yeah. I mean, that's when we talk about process workflows of sorts, you know, in templates as a whole, that's one of my big fears of us potentially moving into another machine. Is if we get into another machine, it's likely going to have a different spindle taper. And if it does, then that, as you said earlier, sometimes one change can mess up your entire workflow. And for us, right, we've got all the tools modeled, the tool holders modeled, and migrating those between two machines is going to be not easily done, at least not with the current set of tools.
When I was at SynCutSyn, they have a UMC and a Matsura. And I think the Matsura is Cat 40 and the UMC is HSK. Or maybe the other way around. I can't remember. But anyway, like, the tools are very close. They were as close as they could get them. But because the tapers are different, They're a little bit different. And the compromise there was to choose the more restrictive case and just accept, like, I think one of them was a few millimeters longer or something. And so you, basically their tool library used that for both of them. And they just accepted that they were giving up a little bit of capacity on sure. the machine that had the smaller tool holders. So there are some ways that you can still get around that problem, but it definitely requires like a high degree of like very intentional standardization, right?
Yeah, you're going to have to do it with a good bit of forethought and planning. You're not going to just jump right into it. It's not good. Be kosher. For us, it'll be interesting. I'll have to see how that goes. SendCut Send, I think, is afforded the luxury of their building out that process, right? So they have the option to pick maybe a tool holder that is available in a similar geometry in both. When we've already got a large library, we'll be sort of searching for one that is similar.
Right, right.
But we're forced into a standard.
I think that's another key point, though, which is that templates and templates do tend to synergize nicely and or force you toward more standardization. The advantages of templates really start to fall apart if every time you do something, the tool holder is a little bit different or the stickout's a little bit different. Like you kind of lose a lot of the advantage, or your work holding is in a different place on the table. So I think putting some thought into standardization before you dive too deeply into templates, or being willing to iterate toward a higher standard, is what is necessary to really get a lot of value out of templates.
Sure. No, I agree with that completely.
Yeah. So I've been in some shops recently where like every tool is built up custom for the job. And I can appreciate where that comes from, especially if you don't want to spend a fortune in tool holders. But these days, there are sometimes some pretty incredible deals on inexpensive holders, especially when Haas wants to have a fire sale. And so one of my top recommendations whenever anybody asks for, like, how do I improve my shop? I'm like, the next time you can buy 100 holders, buy 100 holders and put every drill and every tap, just have them set up ready to go. Really standardize on an ER collet and a certain gauge length tool holder if you can. Or, you know, Rego Fix or Heat Shrink if you want to go up market a little bit more, hydraulics. But standardization is the key there. The more sort of random tool holders you have in your shop, the harder it becomes to leverage templates, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you'll get forced into having to change something to the non-standard, and maybe it would or wouldn't work, but you get, whether you want to or not, you have to do that, or you have to break down other stuff. I think part of the value, like we've talked about with templates, is saving time. And so if you can standardize, and in this case, if you can standardize and have tools pre-set up, or you have enough holders to use the one that's correct, you're going to save time either grabbing those ones that are already set up or not having to double check to see, is this going to have a collision? Is this going to be fine? Because you already know it's fine, right? We've already checked it. Last time I ran it was fine with this. This is what it's supposed to be. And just removes that work out of there. It removes that pain point.
Okay, so templates are awesome. They give you a double benefit out of standardization. They do have some downsides. We talked a little bit about process rigidity and what happens when you want to change your process and if your old files relied on the old process. Do you know of any other like major gotchas on templates that we should look out for?
Nothing's coming to mind immediately. I think just watching out for those process changes, and it might make sense to start small and then work up rather than trying to build out a massively robust system from the jump, just because you're more likely to hit those gotchas. The more your shop has used some sort of standardized workflows, or the longer you've been doing work in a shop, I think the more confidence you'd have going into like, this is how we always do it. Or this is a way that would work for pretty much everything. If you're going to deviate from any sort of templated workflow, I think having some sort of indicator that this is a deviation is also helpful. We talked about you and I offline before. If we deviate from our standard processes, it's a massive deviation. And as soon as I open that file, it's immediately noticeable. And that's sort of a red flag for me. Like, I need to double check everything in this file. And I try to reduce the number of instances when I have to do that. And now we've got to the point, you know, it's only a couple times a year, maybe we have to do that. But for the most part, we know that that's a deviation file. We know that that doesn't follow any of our standard processes. Nothing should be trusted in that file, etc. That way, it doesn't allow you to get
nothing should be trusted.
because I think if you have instances where you deviate from your standard process or your standard template, the warm and fuzzies you get from a template and not having to check stuff creates a bit of a false confidence, and you'll get bit in that file that you deviate. So if you try to still use a lot of your templated stuff in there and make it too clean and nice, you may not realize, like, hey, this is a large deviation.
One tip I've seen from two people recently, John Saunders and Ethan Patain, is they'll throw a sketch into their file and type the notes of the text, like, right into that sketch. So I feel like you should have a template that says, like, non-standard, don't trust anything in here, and put that in a sketch so that, like, you literally cannot miss it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I told you we have some, you know, in some cases we're going to have some really weird work holding, and I'm going to hold it in kind of a sketchy way or sketch. And so in those instances, I won't rely on the 0 point as far as its location. I won't put the work holding in there. I won't. So if I get in that file, it's the Wild West. Nothing exists in that file except for a part and a work coordinate system that's in a weird spot. And so when I click on the setups, because there's an absence of work holding in most cases, because there's not, you know, okay, there's something's weird here. I've also made sometime parts weird colors, gone in the appearance section of Fusion. And rather than them being the standard steel or aluminum looking color of the part, you know, it's bright purple or something.
Neon pink means morning.
Something's going on here. Cause why would we make it this color? This is ridiculous.
I think the other aspect of templates that adds complexity that you and I don't run into very often, cause we're dealing with small teams, 1-2 man teams, is that template drift is a thing, and managing templates in a larger organization can be somewhat challenging. Both in terms of getting templates that get pushed out and showing everybody how to use them and leverage them, but also, what happens when people make process improvements to those templates and getting that all to funnel back into some sort of centralized, unified thing. It's a challenge because there's no like software support in Fusion to really do anything like that. So I think in larger organizations, templates come with a process challenge all their own of like, one, avoiding drift, two, training larger groups of people to leverage the template properly. Because a lot of the safety of the template comes from like following implied processes that are built around the template. And then three, like as they make changes or improvements to that template, making sure those get sucked back in and shared with everybody else. Those are overcomable for sure. They're like a cultural and a management challenge. But I think if you're a larger organization, and I think larger could be really anything more than like one person who's managing the templates and handing them out. If you start going to 2, 3, 4 people, that for me is larger. Then some forethought into like, I would say like housekeeping around the template becomes a challenge that you need to deal with.
That's an interesting idea, and honestly, one I hadn't thought of. So we're still fairly small, right? There's only 2 people in the shop, and right now I'm doing all of the programming, but sometimes my partner there will get in the file and look at what's going on, and he's familiar with, you know, the way that I've set up to do stuff. Besides saving time, though, one of the other things that I've thought about is as we scale up, if somebody else comes in, setting up the templates makes it easier for somebody else to jump in and do it at a high level, right? If we wanted somebody to add complex work holding and this and that, they may just not do it because it's so difficult. But if we make it so easy that they can, then hopefully we can keep a standardized thing there. But I had not given any thought to drift from that or process changes happening at anyone outside of myself. Managing that might be tricky. Some of the stuff like we talked about with probing and probing every single part. I do it a safety check myself, but I also think that flows nicely when you move into any sort of automation. And we could call automation in this case, like another employee that's just running this stuff. It's effectively automation for me, right? Or it could be a robot or a palette changer or something along those lines.
Yes, but I have my 13-year-old robot coming into work later to do some automated machine tending. Yes.
Yeah. So like, if your 13-year-old robot puts the stock in the wrong spot and it probes it and says, hey, this is the wrong size because maybe he rotated it or it's in the wrong location or whatever. I mean, that's a bit of error checking there and maybe saves an expensive thing or maybe at least saves a piece of stock. But the idea of drifting from that and somebody else making deliberate changes to that and how to manage that is not something I'd given any real thought to. I can see how that'd be really tricky.
Yeah, I know Phil is dealing with that for his larger organization, so he's got some thoughts there. But I don't think there's a great solution to it other than to like put some safety processes and discussion around that. So, yeah, when you get your own 13-year-old robot, you'll have to deal with that. Okay, I think that covers it for templates. Is there anything else you can think of that we should go over there?
No, I think that mostly covers it. I think, well, I'll shamelessly bring stuff back to you guys, I guess. One of the interesting things about Toolpath and why I've been interested in it and using it is sort of using that as a template in a way. We've talked about the container method of sorts and using that. And so one of the powerful things with the container method is guys will set up a workflow with all their containers. So they have, part stock and a place for the model to go. But it'll be a workflow that's already set up. If they were going to do tabbing, window machining a part, tap it out, et cetera, all the stuff there is pre-set up. All the tool paths to do that generically. One of the struggles that I've run into in some cases for us is that our parts vary so much that sometimes I need to deviate from what some of my templates are. In some cases, that's drove the template to be more generic or simplistic. And in others, that's drove more than one template. So I need to select it. One of the interesting things about what you guys are doing at Toolpath is the template infusion as it exists sort of needs to be dumb and just look at it. There's no intelligence to it, where Toolpath sort of brings that intelligence in. And so as those kinds of templated workflows get more integrated with Toolpath, it sort of is the template. It will apply the template. So one of the common workflows with the container method a lot of times is that you'd add in a bunch of stuff. And if those are unnecessary toolpaths, you just delete them out. And that's not really needed when you get into something like an AI looking at it, because it won't add those unnecessary ones. It'll just be what it should be. And obviously, mileage is going to vary as it grows, but over time, it's just going to get better and better. And it's more likely that we can start to deviate some of from relying on things like actual CAM and on things like Toolpath to house some of those templates or to create templates on the fly, which is what I think
that's
is interesting.
A really great point, and thank you for the opening. I actually, listeners won't believe that this isn't I'm not trying to make a Toolpath advertisement here. But one of the limitations of templates that we didn't go over, but you bring up, is that if you want to build a complex one with like 3D geometry in a container method, 3D toolpaths in a container method, you can have a lot of toolpaths pre-built and pretty much machine your whole part, almost completely. The guys at Meta do a lot of cool stuff. They've shown where they can have 90% of the programming done just by dropping their part into the part container.
I was just going to interrupt and say Saunders had a pretty good video a couple of years ago showing him doing the same thing with a lathe workflow. So main spindle, sub spindle, and how you could pretty easily on, two axis lathe parts, let's just say, get anything done. But they did just like we're talking about there, here's a handful of toolpaths and maybe there's a grooving toolpath in there and I don't need it, so I'll just delete it out.
Right. But that means that, like, let's say you have just the simplest case, like a quarter inch, a 3/8, and a half inch rougher. You have toolpaths for all of those in there. Depending on the part you put in, you may need one, two, or all three of those. If you don't need them, you have to delete them out. And so in a sense, the automation that you can build with a toolpath is, it's rigid in the sense that, like, you are building an automation with a specific tool and a specific toolpath. And where we're trying to get to with capital T toolpath is a smarter level of automation where it'll choose the tools that it needs and give you toolpaths. We're trying really hard to get to a place where you tell toolpath how to program. And so, like you said, the quote template becomes more you expressing your intent in our process definition. And then you get, you know, hopefully some large percentage of the work done for you by the AI kind of following your intent.
Yeah. I mean, Autodesk has dipped their toes in that a bit with things like the whole library, right?
Whole recognition.
Whole recognition. Where they've got some automation, and in some cases you can leverage that to do some bores, interpolating with an end mill or drilling and tapping. But there's not really any focus on feature matching and applying tools to that, which is what your guys' entire focus is. I don't know that there's going to be a day when Autodesk, or at least not in the future, tries to apply, you know, this obscure dovetail cutter or this obscure key cutter or something like that to a part. Not only that, I think toolpath right now goes a bit further with the recommendations, right? Most of the time when we're talking about templates or we're talking about container method templates, we're talking about tools that you already have and you've already defined and said it could go through, not tools that may exist in the wild, but I don't have, and maybe don't even know that that geometry exists yet, right? I don't know that there is one that is this size with this length and this reach, etc. So I think that's an interesting tie back to this whole conversation with toolpath, is that what you guys are building, at least from my viewpoint, is sort of that same sort of matching like we're talking about with container stuff, but not with known tools or not with known toolpaths. It's just anything. We'll figure it on the fly. Figure it out on the fly dynamically.
Undercut tool matching was like this huge endeavor that I only just now feel like we're really starting to get a good handle on. And now we're starting to move on to, we do feature recognition for dovetails, but we're starting to do feature tool matching for dovetails now too.
And that's not something I've ever put in any container method of mine. I've never put a dovetail cutter. It just because I don't use them enough to where I would want that in every one. So I'd more than likely be deleting it out of most files. And then, you know, we've got quite a few key cutters and dovetails and this and that. But I'm not going to stick all of those in there. So that way all of them pre-exist. So, yeah, like that sort of container or template just can't exist in Fusion. And that's where I find what you guys are doing really interesting.
Cool. Well, we mentioned robots. Mine has shown up and is ready to load some parts. So I think we'll call it there. I actually learned quite a bit here, Garrett. So thanks for jamming out on templates with me. We'll have to do it again soon when we have some more process built up around replacing templates with toolpath when you feel like we've reached there. Offline, I'll share some of the latest stuff with you on merging toolpath with your existing templates. I'm almost ready to share that with insiders. So.
Oh, nice. That sounds great.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Garrett. Great talking to you. Let's do it again soon.
Sounds good. Great talking to you also.